Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 14 of Mic Check on Sports. I'm Steve Napolitani. Seems like everyone is talking about The Last Dance on ESPN. As good as it is, boy, do we need sports back in a big way. Advertisers will be lining up to get back on the scene as well. My next guest has called over 20 Stanley Cup finals. He has won a record-setting 6 consecutive sports Emmys for play-by-play, and he has pretty much added a new chapter to the hockey term dictionary. It's the legendary Mike Doc Emmerich. Doc, how are you?
Good, Woj. How are you?
I'm doing well. So how are you occupying your time these days?
Well, until the end of March, I was pretty much involved in the finishing off of a book. I was very lucky to ally myself with Kevin Allen, who for 34 years covered hockey for USA Today. And he and I started working on I guess you would call it an autobiographical book, but it's more about hockey than it is about me, although it does take some chapters of my life in with it, and combines it with a lot of stories from hockey, as well as a few from football and baseball. But the deadline to have all of it done was March 31st, so when the NHL hit pause on the 12th of March, I was not without something to do. Then when we hit the deadline of the 31st of March, on the 2nd of April, they called and said, we need a rewrite on chapters 1 and 2. Well, that involved Kevin more than it did me, because anyone who's ever worked on a book realizes that if you're collaborating with somebody who is a skilled writer, he has the heavy lifting, and the person that just dictates does not. So he has had the heavier work to do, but it's pretty well done and will come out in the fall. So that took up a good deal of the time, and then there have been some other projects that NBC has going, because like a lot of sports networks, we've been carrying a lot of the games from the past because there are no live events to do. So I've not been without things to do, but obviously all of us in sports would like to be doing live events, but we have to sit back and wait right now.
Right. And I started this podcast because a lot of people are missing their familiar voices from sports, and it gets us to get a little deeper look at you guys. And you grew up in Indiana. Was sports always a big influence on your life?
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of us have had that. When we get into a career in sports, it's not because we see it as a good way to make money. Right. It's because we love sports, and we have ever since we were little kids. And I think that's probably what gets us there. You know, once in a while I'll speak to a journalism class, and if it's a small enough class, I'll ask each of them to stand up and recall the first event that they ever attended. And that'll be either a pro or a college event, anything major that they ever attended for the very first time. And invariably, they will remember a lot of details about it, including what the sky was like, what the stadium looked like, and invariably, as they recall the details of the day, they'll remember who they were with, and they'll have the whole memory with a smile on their face. That's what gets all of us into this, and I think that's what keeps all of us into it, and has us holding on for dear life throughout our lives for long careers, because we just enjoy it so much. And I have seen Pete Vukovic being struck out now 4 times by Charlie Sheen. And I have seen the Pirates bullpen fail with the left-hander from Nebraska to get Robert Redford out in the bottom of the ninth. And I've seen all of these things more times than I want to, but I'm still drawn back to them because there really isn't an alternative for people that like sports other than things that we already know the outcome on. But someday in the future, with all of the frontliners doing the noble work that they're doing, maybe we'll get a chance to do what we do. We hope sooner, but probably not as soon as we want to.
Right. And I know you grew up a big Pittsburgh Pirates baseball fan. Did you ever have aspirations of wearing the black and gold?
No, I never was going to be a very good athlete, and I knew that from a very young time. But I experienced sports vicariously, like so many people do, and wanted to be a baseball announcer until I saw Hockey Live for the first time. That was a minor league team in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And it was at that point, at age 14, that I decided I wanted to be a hockey announcer. And you consider, if you've seen the movie Hoosiers, that was our era. Mm. And the size of our gym was the same size as the one at Hickory. And we had a stage at the end where the band sat. Mm-hmm. And the other end, the trophy case was not far away, just like that. And we had 13 celebrities in our town of 600, the basketball coach and the 12 varsity players. Mm. It was the same thing. So wow. If you can imagine coming from a town that size and wanting to be a professional hockey announcer, right. It just seemed incongruous. But fortunately, I was very lucky. I got a chance to do what I really wanted to do.
That is great. And I did hear a story that you actually were a piano mover as a kid with your brother.
Oh, my word. Where did you hear that? Yes, of course it's true. My dad was a high school principal who was one of the rarities in Indiana. He became a principal after he was a band director, not a basketball coach. Mm-hmm. And he had a music store on the side. And whenever we would sell a keyboard instrument, like a large organ or a piano, my brother and I would move it. And even though neither of us really looked like piano movers, we sure enough were. And yeah, you're absolutely right. One Christmas Eve, there was a man who ran a store that sold outboard motors, and mm-hmm. there weren't many lakes in Indiana, but he did a very good business. And so as a reward to his family, he got the family a console organ and a piano for Christmas, but he wanted it delivered after midnight on Christmas Eve. So here we are in snowy Indiana, the three of us, my brother, my father, and I, lugging these two keyboard instruments up a set of steps after midnight so that his family doesn't wake up.
Wow.
And getting these things into his living room so that they can all be surprised on Christmas morning.
That's a tremendous story. Wow. You first went to Manchester University in Indiana, then you got your bachelor's, then you got your master's at Miami of Ohio, and then finally got your PhD in communication at Bowling Green State, not without the help of legendary Tigers broadcaster Ernie Harwell. How did that all come about?
Well, and when you get a PhD, you have to, in essence, write a book, mm-hmm. Which is called a dissertation. And I had done all my coursework, and the only thing left was to finish that. And so, because Bowling Green was only about an hour and a half south of Detroit, and I heard Ernie broadcast all the time, and I also heard that he was a good person. Mm-hmm. I thought, I need somebody that can help me filter out the subject that I had chosen, which was play-by-play baseball announcers. There had never been a history done of baseball broadcasting, you know, a scholarly history, as they call it in academe. And if I could get him to agree to help me be my non-academic advisor to my dissertation. So I wrote a letter to him, and true to form, it took about 3 days for it to get there and 3 days for him to respond. And he said, sure, come on up to Tiger Stadium and we'll talk about it. And so I took my tape recorder up and sat with him two different sessions. And he was just fantastic. He probably did it for 200 other people, but he agreed to go over my questionnaire that I sent to all the broadcasters in Major League Baseball. And he also, he agreed to read the final product that I was submitting to my five PhD advisors.
Wow.
And he was just magnificent and an even better person than he was a non-academic advisor, as you could imagine.
That's good. And you started your professional career calling games for the Port Huron Flags. What did you learn from that first experience?
Well, I was doing the dissertation at the same time I was riding the buses with these hockey players, and I was told by the announcer in Dayton, near where I'd gone to graduate school, that the players would teach me the sport, and they sure enough did. I tried to be as open-minded as possible on the bus to learn and soak up as much information as I could, and they were very good teachers. It was a part of a culture that I hadn't learned, but I was learning on the fly, and I realized what real courage was, because the game in the 70s was different than the game now.
Right.
It required a lot of stitches and a lot of painkillers and everything else, because it was a vicious game. And especially at the IHL level, which was two phone calls away from the NHL at that time, there were a lot of ice bags on those buses, and I wasn't much on drinking beer or anything, but Toledo was such a violent place to try and get out of that I would have one can of beer a year, and that would be after the last game in Toledo because we had escaped it again.
Oh, then you spent three seasons for the AHL Maine Mariners before getting your first NHL gig with the Devils. Did you feel when you got that Devils gig that you quote-unquote made it?
Well, yes. The Mariners were the primary farm team of the Philadelphia Flyers, and they were the American League team, so now it was only one phone call away. Mm-hmm. And the Flyers tended to promote from within, so after 3 years in Maine and two championships, because the Flyers wanted to make sure that their players had a winning experience, they were only recently away from their two Stanley Cups back-to-back. Mm-hmm. And so they put their farm team in Maine, and we won championships back-to-back there. The Flyers promoted me from within into Philadelphia to do pay cable for them for 3 years, and then I got a chance to go with Madison Square Garden Network and do the New Jersey Devils. And yes, because the arrangement at that time in New York with Madison Square Garden was also cable of the Devils, mm-hmm. but Channel 9 as well. And so now to be on a superstation, mm-hmm. where Devils games, even though the team wasn't very good at that time in the early 80s, to have your broadcast going on a superstation, that was exposure far beyond my wildest dreams. And so you would have a feeling that, yeah, you're getting an enormous opportunity here to sharpen your skills and to have your description go out to where other people can see it. You're right.
You know, I heard you once talk about a conversation that Lou Lamoriello had, and he said to you, "You're not good to us if you can't be believed." Is that one of those statements that you have taken with you throughout your career?
Yeah, no, you're right. It was just, that's a remarkable memory on your part. It was just after I had left Philadelphia for the second time in 1993. You know, in a one-team town, there are expectations as to how you approach it. And I had realized the first time with the Devils that Madison Square Garden said, "Look, we know you're following a team all year, but we have the fans of a number of teams living in the metropolitan area of New York. So your approach is going to need to be different here." And it was more of a network approach rather than as a one-team town partiality approach, which I was a lot more comfortable with anyway. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Look, you know, it's in a one-team town, sometimes you're expected to be partial." And I was not necessarily comfortable with that. And mm-hmm. he said, "You've got to be able to say what you think. And if you can't say what you think, you're not any good to us." Mm-hmm. And so that was very good to hear coming into my time with what was then Sports Channel New York and later Madison Square Garden Network, where that was what they wanted. Yes, we were following the Devils, and we were spending a lot of time. I think it was about a 70-30 approach, we felt, mm-hmm. talking about the Devils 70% of the time and the other team 30, whereas with a network telecast, it would be 50-50.
Right.
But in terms of being overtly partial, it was a far different thing than what you would have if you were doing the broadcast in a one-team town.
Right. And then, you know, you didn't have an easy commute. You didn't live around the corner from Brendan Byrne Arena where the Devils played. You lived in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Did you enjoy that 2.5-hour ride each way to kind of reflect on things? Did you listen to other games on the radio? What was that commute like?
Well, it was before satellite radio, unfortunately, so that you really had to trust the 50,000-watt stations that occasionally had hockey games on that you could listen to. Mm-hmm. So as a result, fortunately, I had the privilege of bringing a statistician for a telecast. First, it was Pat Summers, and later it was Larry Gaines along with me. So I had company for the trip up and back. But I would leave at about 7:30 in the morning so I could make it to New Jersey in time for the 10:30 skate, and then would head back after the game was over and arrive back home around 1:30. I didn't find it bad because it was not every day. It was just on home game days. You think that's 41 days a year, over 6 months. That's not hard. Right. It's not like somebody's doing that every day. Plus, I had company, as I said. Mm-hmm. I had good conversationalists, and we had the radio, and we would agonize, oh good, the Blackhawks are playing tonight. We can get that on the radio on the way home. So we had something to listen to for a good part of the trip back home. So it was an enjoyable time. And of course, during that period of time, the Devils were really good. Mm-hmm. So there was plenty of enjoyable things to talk about on the way up as well as the way back. So I wouldn't trade those years for anything. The one thing I discovered was that when my wife and I first moved to Hershey, it was 100 miles to Philadelphia. It was 185 to the Meadowlands. Wow. So it was a tougher commute. And I think the one thing that kind of gave me the idea that, hey, maybe this is a little bit tough, is one night I saw at about 1 o'clock in the morning, a van in front of me about a quarter of a mile went across the road and hit the center abutment and then caromed back across the road and went into a ditch. And I don't think the driver was inebriated. I think he just got tired, went to sleep. And I thought to myself, you know, that could be me some night. And so it was at that point that I asked Pete Silverman, who was in charge of Madison Square Garden Network, if it really mattered where I lived, because I worked for a network, not the team. Mm-hmm. And he said, no, it really doesn't. And so it was at that point that Joyce and I relocated back to Michigan, and we've been here ever since. Hmm.
And then you know, you've had special relationships in the Devils organization, obviously Chico Resch, Stan Fischler. But one I'm sure Devil fans would love to hear about is Chuck the Duck.
Chuck the Duck was actually a creation of, I guess it was an outgrowth of our producer Roland Dratch liked to have fun. And when he first took over, it was during the lockout. Jackie Lyons had been a very capable producer of Devils hockey up through the 94-95 season. And then in the fall of 94, we went through a lockout. And what we started doing, again, Pete was in charge of the Garden productions at that time. We started doing Albany River Rats games, and many of the future Devils who were on the championship team that same season were playing in Albany. Brian Ralston and Sergey Breland, people like that, were playing for the Albany River Rats. We did 7 River Rats games, but Roland was going to be our producer for the Devils, but like everything else, was locked out, so he became our producer of River Rats games in Albany. And he started the tradition of having Stan tell a joke to start it all off. And, and Stan would have the lucky ducky thing that he would do in the intermissions. It was kind of crazy. But anyway, out of that came Chuck the Duck. And Chuck became a fixture of a lot of the road games. And he was this stuffed animal that, because of Stan's history with Groucho Marx, Roland and Larry Gaines put a cigar in his mouth, and and then it evolved into Chuck the Duck showing up at different places, like in Vancouver near the bridge that spanned one of the rivers there, and then he would ride a water ski down in Sunrise, Florida. He was actually kidnapped by one of the producers of the Rangers games and hidden for a period of time. So Chuck took on a life of his own, that and Chico Eats, which was another part of the Devil's telecast, where Chico would go around the new arena in Newark to a different food station each time, and kids would follow him around, and they would sample the food. Well, anyway, when I left the Devil's broadcast as a closing gesture, the television crew gave me Chuck the Duck, who is now enclosed in glass,
still with
the cigar and smiling in the trophy case down in the basement.
That is awesome. And then you actually, you know, spent some time calling the NFL on Fox. Did you enjoy calling the NFL?
Yeah, it was work, though.
Yeah,
I admire Sam and the other people who do NFL games on a regular basis, but I found it was work. I got to do 7 games, and it was when I was working with the Flyers. Stipulation was I couldn't miss a Flyers game for an NFL game. So it was normally games in September before the Flyers started the regular season. But this was on CBS before a lot of the personnel at CBS went to Fox, so it would be easy to confuse the two. But it was 2 games with Matt Millen, who had just retired from his career as a three-time Super Bowl player, and then five times with Hank Stram. Sometimes they would need six crews because of the way the schedule fell. They would need six crews, and so I was the guy that they would call on to be on the sixth crew. We would normally work in small market games. For example, we would do a Green Bay Minnesota game because those were small markets. The regular guys that worked every week would do the bigger cities. So I had a Green Bay Tampa Bay, Green Bay Minnesota, you know, places like that. And that was what enabled me to wind up by accident calling Brett Favre's first Packer pass and his first NFL completion after four. After four passes with the Atlanta Falcons that were not completed, his first completion was to himself.
Right. And then you've worked so many Olympics over the years. Of course, ice hockey, but you also did water polo. Does the novelty of working the Olympics ever wear off?
No, I think the one thing that you recognize is that when you're going there, you're going to work. Because even in water polo, it's usually 16 out of the 17 days you work. The first one in particular in Athens, we had one or two matches every day. And then the day before the gold medal game, you had off. So if you got to see anything, it was usually right before that. I mean, you're there to work, and I didn't complain about that at all. Right. So I got to see the Acropolis and a few things like that the day before the gold medal game. I got to call the women's gold medal victory against Spain in London in 2012 in women's water polo. And also one of the Royals was there wearing a baseball cap to watch the English women's team play, which was kind of exciting. Prince Harry was there, and he was blending in with the rest of the crowd when the British team played. So that was kind of interesting. But I think probably the most memorable from the U.S. standpoint in ice hockey was the women's gold medal victory in 1998, the first time that the women ever competed for medals in Nagano, as well as the U.S.-Canada showdown in Vancouver when Sidney Crosby scored in overtime after Zach Parise had tied it up late in the game. And then the remarkable performance by T.J. Oshie against the Russians in 2014 in Sochi.
Yeah. And then, you know, you've called over 20 Stanley Cup finals. How much do you relish those moments?
Well, they're the most important times of the year for the fans. And so what you hope to do is to make the games memorable without getting in the way of them, because it's about the players and it's about their performances. And so at that time of year, though, the one thing you want to do is to make sure that the memory stays, but that you're a part of it, but out of the way of it, because it's a part of celebrating what these players have gone through to get there. And in a lot of cases, some of them have played 100 games to get that chance to either win or to lose in the seventh game. You can't imagine a short summer for both Boston and St. Louis last year, a very short summer, but they both played around 100 games and in some cases more than that, to earn that short summer, either a summer of celebration or a summer of disappointment.
I've had the honor to work in the production truck for a lot of your games that you've called, and on multiple occasions of a closer big game, the analyst you were working with hit us on talkback, and they often say, let Doc do his thing now, meaning they're going to let you carry the broadcast. They're only going to speak when necessary. The folks in the truck will cut back on replays, all to allow you to capture the moment. To me, that is the ultimate respect. What does that mean to you?
Well, it means a lot. I don't know that it's going on, and it's nice of you to say, because I've not been aware of it, but I know that sometimes Eddie Olczyk will just, you know, during a commercial break, he'll say, all you, Doc, or he knows that after all these years of working together that there'll be a time that he'll jump in, but it'll usually be an inconsequential time when a defenseman is holding the puck behind his own net for both teams to make a change, or if there's a transition at center ice and there's nothing dangerous going on, just to give me a chance to catch a breather. Mm-hmm. So he's very attuned to that, and also realizes that if it's a one-goal game or if the game is tied and it's getting late, that the last thing that is necessary at that point is anything extra. And it's also a temptation for us to not want to jam in a story or something extraneous to the only thing that anyone wants at that time is the play-by-play. I got a chance to spend quite a bit of time with Marty Glickman, who's a legend in sports broadcasting, and he would always emphasize that to me. He would look at my work, and he was a coach for us with Sports Channel for several years when I was doing the Devils, and he would say, always remember that people are tuning in to watch the athletes, and they want to know what's going on with the game. Anything extra you can do, fine, but don't get it in the way of the action.
Hmm. Great advice. Do you have a favorite call or a game that you did? I mean, you've done so many.
I've done over 3,700 games, but I can, you know, this is off the wall, but I can tell you one special night that was a lot of fun for me to be in an arena. During one of the lockouts, Brian Williams for the NBC was doing a Friday night news magazine show. And it was during one of the lockouts, I think it might have been in November, that he said, "I'll bet Doc's driving his wife crazy. How about we send him out to do a kids' game?" So they got this, and Brian's daughter had been a hockey player in her younger days. She later went on to be a star in an HBO series. But anyhow, they picked out an under 12 girls game at a suburban rink near Detroit that was close for me. It was only about an hour away. And it was the St. Clair Shores Saints against the Troy Sting. Mm. And Doug Brown, who actually was a Stanley Cup winner, played in the NHL for a number of years, Boston College guy, was coaching one of the teams. And so anyway, the people that they had producing the game, it was going to be recorded and edited down to be a, I don't know, a 10-minute piece or something, did all of the background on all of the young girls that were going to be playing in the game, and they had note cards with biographical data. Wow. It was hilarious. But I got to go in and talk to the girls in each dressing room before the game. One was going to be a concert violinist. One was going to be a veterinarian, she said. And I asked her what kind of pets she had at home. She had a dog, two cats, and hermit crabs. And I said, "Well, that's interesting. What do they eat?" She said, "Little rolled up bits of lettuce." So somehow or other that made it onto the broadcast. But it was one of the most fun nights I ever spent in an arena in that it was just an activity for these kids.
Right.
They were going to go off and do other things with their lives besides play hockey, but they were having a great time doing it, and that was what the whole evening was about. And I walked out of there, and I just thought, well, this was a pure evening of hockey. Everybody had a great time. And even though one team won and one team lost, they all shook hands, and they posed for a group picture after. Wasn't that nice?
Right. I heard you say in an interview one time, "We could sure dwell in the past and have big smiles on your faces." Do you at times pause and smile at the career you've had?
Yeah, you do. I've been lucky enough to live through two different eras of the sport. There was the rough and tumble part of the 70s and early 80s when there were fights all the time. And then there's the modern era, which is much faster and much more athletic. I understand that. But I'm thrilled by both of the eras that I've lived through, and I enjoy everything about the sport. I don't think you'd call me a grumpy old man. I really do enjoy everything that I've had to do with the sport, and it's been very good to me. I've been blessed with some good health despite having a cancer surgery back in 1991 early. I'm very lucky. I'm very lucky.
Well, Doc, I will say it's a pleasure to work with you. It's a pleasure to listen to you. And if not everybody saw it, Doc's NBC Sports letter to the workers that he voiced And he ends it with, you know, hope can't wait till we could do our part to help. I can't wait till you and myself can get back to work and do our part to help America and bring back sports.
I agree. And in the meantime, we just pay our tribute to all of those that are going out and hopefully getting us this victory over the virus someday. But God bless them all.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much, Woj.
All right. Thank you, Doc. Take care.
Okay. You too.
Doc's career is one for the books. As good as he is on the air, the person he is off the air is 100 times that. He is always such a gentleman. On the next episode of Mike Check on Sports, we will check in with the Yak, WFAN and CBS Sports Radio's Rich Ackerman. Take care, brush your hair.